Previously on Nothing Borrowed, Nothing Gained.
For the last 20 years, we've been in this low interest rate environment.
As you step out on that yield curve, as you reach out to get higher and higher rates of return, you take on more and more risk.
Asset prices increased and commodity prices increased.
When things are going very well, everybody loves agriculture.
No one is in this alone.
The government takes all the risk and the private sector makes the money.
We know that the data we're using is not very good.
Not just sloppy, but intentionally streamlined, incomplete, I would say, underwriting of loans.
There's an old saying in banking, right? A fast yes and a faster no.
Monetary policy acts with long and variable lags.
Inverted yield curves can be signs of a pending recession.
At the end of the day, they're left with, like, why me? Why did this happen to me? And those are heartbreaking stories.
I'm meeting with this one, and he's telling me, I said, I'm probably your most stable tenant you're going to have this spring because I'm with Production Credit Association, and I'm in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They're going to get the money.
This is Nothing Borrowed, Nothing Gained, the story of ag lending, past, present, and future. I'm Sarah Mock. The first story we ever told on this podcast was about the 1980s farm crisis. That event has had a long shadow that, in a lot of ways, has shaped the understanding and defined the careers of many people in agriculture. But as we head into 2023 and beyond, more than one of our sources pointed out that it's been 50 years since the industry was in the thick of that crisis, and for all the fear and angst its memory recalls, people are also starting to forget.
People are less risk adverse, and people that come out of the farm crisis of the 80s into the 90s and the 00s, you always had that perspective in your mind that says, I saw this when, you know, values fell 40% or whatever. As you see a new generation coming in and becoming loan officers and stuff, they don't have that perspective. And I think people get more comfortable taking on debt, being the borrowers and also the lenders extending more debt as that history fades away. And like many people we have today, never even experienced that firsthand. They read about it in a textbook.
As Jeff Conrad of Agis Capital points out here, not that many people who are around today were already running farm businesses during or before the 1970s and continue to make decisions and plan for the future today. But even in cases where people do have access to that kind of experience and insight, sometimes all of that, plus knowledge, data, and wisdom, are still not enough. There's one particular case that happened not 50 years ago, but 5 or so. And it's the final story we'll share here, as we think in particular about the future of the farm financial system. It's the case of Boursin Farms, an enormous crop farm in Michigan at its peak totaling about 83,000 acres that in around 2017 started to, quite infamously, come up against some problems with ag lending. Today, we'll dig into the Boursin Farm story, and in discussing what happened there, who is at fault, and what it does or does not foretell about the future of ag lending, I'll do my best to tie up any loose ends here and bring everything we've learned this season together. But first, to Michigan. To guide us through the details of the Boursin Farm story, we'll hear from one last news source.
My name is Brent King, and I'm a managing director at B. Riley Advisory Services. I'm an expert at restructuring bankrupt companies, and I also am a fourth-generation farmer from the state of Illinois.
Brent King is a busy guy who spoke to me during a hectic travel week for him, so please excuse the audio quality. He's been keeping a close eye on what's happened at Boursin Farms over the last several years.
So Boursin Farms decided they wanted to be big at all costs. They wanted to be the biggest farm in Michigan, and that was their goal. So they broke the first rule of agriculture, and that is farming does not support high debt loads. But Boursin Farms secured very high debt loads. And they did that through non-traditional ag lenders. I assert there is not an ag lender in America who would have ever financed that big of a mess. So they Borsons got financing through CHS.
In 2017, Borson Farms was sued by CHS Capital Inc. for defaulting on a $135.3 million loan. That case has since been settled, but it was just the first claim of many. And in addition to the significant loan from CHS, it also had real estate and equipment loans from other parties, many of which totaled in the tens of millions of dollars each, including numerous handshake lease agreements. But I think one of the most interesting aspects of this story is that Borson Farms was not even the first huge farm to run into problems with scale and debt on many of these exact same acres in Michigan. Years before Borson's troubles, David Stamp, owner of Stamp Farms, got in some hot water when he tried to get a $68 million loan from Wells Fargo. The problem was, the financial data he used to apply for the loan turned out to be fraudulent. And in 2021, Stamp was convicted of bank fraud. The good news in all of this from Brent King's perspective is that he doesn't think that the situation at Borson's, or Stamp's, is an indicator of some fundamental flaw in the farm financial system.
It's a one-off. That's not the dead canary in the coal mine. That is just a huge mistake. It was an trader who decided he wanted to have the largest farm in some space, and come hell or high water, that's what was going to happen. And he did it. He did. He had the largest farm in Michigan, one of the largest crop farms in America. But it didn't work out because it wasn't structured on sound finance and operational practice. It was just big for the sake of big. It's interesting, there's a much healthier debt load in agriculture today than there was in the 70s. So you're not going to see the same level of crisis. But you are going to see isolated mistakes, potentially fraudulent farm activities. Even a shift in commodity prices could push some people to the point of having unsustainable debt. So we see interruptions in markets. We see raising interest rates. All of those things are drivers of distress.
For our purposes, these drivers of distress, rather than the specific details of Borson Farms, matter the most, especially how these drivers collided with plans to expand and use leverage to do it. I asked Brent King why he thinks this situation got so out of control. He pointed to factors that too often lead to negative outcomes, the first of which affects farmers the most.
High commodity prices drive many of the bad decisions farmers make. And I'm not going to just limit this to farmers. High prices kind of trip up a lot of business operators, but especially farmers. They are convinced that because they had two really good years that they can then go out and buy the neighbor's farm because, heck, I just $14 soybeans in October, so I'm going to the farm sale in January and I'm going to spend the money I made and I'm going to spend all the money I make for the next 20 years off of these $14, $15 beans that I just sold. Well, the problem is, you made the down payment, you got the loan, but beans aren't going to stay at $14. And this is the other fundamental rule of commodity pricing, commodities are most accurately priced when they equal the cost of production. And that is a really grim reality that commodity producers face. So you have to look at the high years of profit and the low years of losses and equalize them and create longer-term concepts of farms' productivity as farms' ability to generate profits. So it's like you get one or two really good years. 2012 was a really good year. 2013, things started to turn around fast. And it took several years for farmers to really realize then, 14, 15, and 16, shoot, I wish I hadn't bought that farm because I can't make the payments now.
Failure to recognize that debt is usually taken on in good times but paid for in bad ones is only half the equation that leads to massive problems like the one in Michigan. The other factor sits on the other side of the table.
Inexperience with agricultural lending. I think they were motivated by people who had not seen how big a mess a large loan can create in agriculture. You have to really look at the debt in two tranches. You have to see the capital debt for land, what do we owe on the farm? When you go to a farming enterprise, and not only is the land essentially fully or almost completely leveraged, but their operating capital is essentially coming from a creditor. in essence, they don't own their own farm. They may on paper own the farm, but they don't really have any equity in it, and they don't even have any equity in their own production operations. We see that in receiverships and in bankruptcies where farms are just massively leveraged. It's a big problem.
The combination of inexperience in ag and thus failure to understand and fully appreciate factors like a farm's debt-to-asset ratio is likely a bigger problem right now than many realize. Though, as Brent King points out, many large banks who lacked ag-specific expertise left ag lending after 2013. As we know, the vacuum has largely been filled by non-bank lenders and alternatives like vendor credit. But Brent saw more than just cold feet due to declining commodity prices in this action. He thinks that around that time, banks recognized something critical that many others ignored.
So they had already woken up and seen that there's a great deal of potential risk in the exposure. And the fundamental problem that you're looking at here is that land values are decoupled in a financial or economic sense from the potential profits that farmers can earn. So saying to me that going out tomorrow and spending $17,000 an acre to grow corn in Illinois and doing that with a heavy amount of debt financing, you can't convince me that I'm going to make that money back growing corn. So drivers of high prices are coming from people who have money, whether that's farmers or whether it's investors. My firm advised, and I worked heavily on the Easterday Ranch bankruptcy. And in Easterday, Esau, the Mormon Church, and the Bill Gates Foundation were the two contending bidders for the 22,000 acres of that ranch. So you see people who have very large amounts of money competing for these very large farms, but you also see it on a local basis where a well-established farmer who might also own a small ag business that's been very good to him or his family, they may say, you know what, we like farming, we want to be involved with agriculture, we're okay with this relatively low rate of return, and that's where we want to put our money so that we can continue to farm. And so those are the actual primary drivers of really high prices of farmland. Because it's not the profit off corn that supports $17,000 an acre farmland.
In our conversation about farmland prices a few episodes ago, I'm not sure any of our experts really put the reality of today's farmland prices as neatly as Brent just did. It's so important to recognize this new motivation in the farmland market. To take us all the way back for a minute, remember the analogy of the diner where I wanted a small business loan to buy a new cooktop? The parallel here would be, consider if in the market for commercial kitchenware, you couldn't just open up a catalog and select from a menu of options, but you instead had to bid against other restaurants for a limited number of stoves. If the price goes too high, do you forego the expansion or bite the bullet and bid up the value, but in turn, lock in a lower rate of return for yourself? Does the calculus change if, instead of neighboring restaurants in these bidding wars, more and more often it's not restaurants at all? It's collectors or people using cooktops for their home or for a hobby. This is undoubtedly a challenging position for a low-margin business. It's easy to focus on why this makes the market for buying assets costly and risky for farmers. But it's worth noting that this market is also quite risky for financiers. See, because the problem with these alternative motives is that they inflate the price while leaving the underlying reality of the asset unchanged. In other words, if a loan is made for an inflated price and then defaults, the bank will likely be stuck reselling the asset for less than the loan was originally made for. This is a major factor that drove big banks out of ag lending a decade ago. It's not that they weren't up for the cyclicality of agriculture, it's that they determined the risk of lending to farm businesses to buy farmland, the price of which no longer correlated to productivity, was too high. I think there's an argument to be made, perhaps the reigning argument in today's ag sector, that it really doesn't matter why farmland is priced the way it is. It costs what it costs, and farmers who want to grow have to find a way to afford it, or potentially find another career path. But Brent King is quick to remind us, in finding a way, high levels of debt simply cannot be the answer.
Farming is tried and true and proven. And farming has proven time and again that it does not support high levels of debt because commodities are priced basically on the global supply of that commodity. And someone in Iowa who's looking at $20,000 an acre for the 80 acres across the road is competing on a soybean grower scale with someone in Brazil who just is able to buy their land for a fraction of that price. And so they're both dumping into the same hopper, the global hopper of soybeans. And so we know that someone is going to eat your lunch if you're overly leveraged.
One of the ways that lunches are already getting eaten, when interest rates rise, like they are today.
Climbing interest rates always put pressure on debtors. They consume profits. They make it more difficult for a farmer to get the financing they might need, or any business owner. Interest rates are an uncontrollable expense that can't be shed by a business. And we know that that rising interest rates will force more businesses into bankruptcy or an insolvency proceeding than would have happened had they not gone up. So we watch that. Those that are leveraged are always at risk.
I think it's worth taking a beat to recognize that the stability and cost of leverage is not by far the only factor that's likely to shift in the coming months and years. In addition to the high levels of volatility in interest rates and in commodity and input prices, there's also factors like climate change, which are creating additional risks in the farm financial system, not only in terms of how farms themselves plan, operate, and navigate through weather events, but also how federal insurance programs work as they begin to be utilized more and more, costing taxpayers an increasing amount. Compound that with the modern shift in thinking about farm businesses, away from maximizing yields and towards maximizing profit, especially over the long term, and how that's affecting everything in the farm ecosystem from practices to purchases. Plus, there's a growing world population, one growing wealthier, not to mention increasing demands for sources of renewable fuel, creating upside potential or positive risk for agriculture in the future. Tom Honig, like many before him, points out that relatively low levels of leverage in ag today are a positive sign as we look ahead.
And that is a very important factor that may allow us to avoid an overwhelming ag crisis that might come if interest rates get to 10, 11, 12% again as the central bank clamps down and as quantitative tightening takes hold. Because once liquidity is pulled out of the system, then those values will stop rising. It's whether or not they begin to fall that will affect the asset balances on the books of those banks.
Though it's promising to hear that ag may be well situated to withstand an overwhelming crisis, even a relatively moderate crisis for the whole industry will inevitably lead, for at least a few, to the worst case scenario, insolvency. Brent King has guided many families and businesses through restructures and bankruptcies over the years, and has seen the pain and heartbreak that process often creates. And in so many cases, he says, it might have been avoided.
If I could ask one question of every farmer who's thinking about borrowing money, that question would be, tell me exactly how you're going to pay this back. Because I have a sense that many of the times when we see companies and farms that are in trouble, they simply borrowed money because they could, because there was a lender that was willing to allow them to borrow the money. And so they take it, they get the new tractor, they get the farm next door, whatever it is, but they've never really sat down with a cash flow and modeled out exactly, realistically, how they're going to pay that debt back. So that's the analysis that needs to be done. Now, the bitter part about that analysis is that sometimes it really does lead to the conclusion that this farm is not viable. Some people who have farming operations that appear to be unlikely to succeed because of their debt ratios, but yet they survive until some giant collapse actually occurs. You started all this with a question about the Borson farms, and I think that they made all of those mistakes at that farm. I don't think their cash flows were realistic. I've never seen them, but my guess is that they had never asked themselves the real hard question, exactly how am I going to pay this back? Farms that fail often believe that if they can continue to farm and continue to grow, they can continue to absorb more debt, and that is not necessarily true.
Brent King does a great job here navigating the razor's edge of credit, which is only getting sharper. Because again, if you walk away with anything from this season, it should be the lesson that credit is a powerful and sometimes dangerous tool. And one, as Nate Franzine of Dakota First points out, is not only useful, it's often essential.
And a certain amount of leverage can be healthy. And quite frankly, in a business like agriculture, that is very capital intense, takes a lot of money to buy a piece of ground, to buy a piece of equipment, to farm. There's a lot of capital needed. You know, certainly some people are blessed to have positioned their farms and ranches to not need to borrow money, and good for them. That's great. But it's not very realistic for everybody. It takes a lot of money. And if you think about a young person wanting to get into farming, it's almost impossible for a young person to do that without borrowing money. It just costs too much. And you have to spend $350,000 just to get one combine or one tractor. How many people just have that laying around? Not a very high percentage of the population, right? So it takes debt to help people get into the business and to help people grow their business. And as long as they manage that appropriately, that's a very healthy part of business. And debt has a place, but it really does need to be managed.
Managing debt and the risk it brings is challenging work. Hopefully the stories you've heard here offer you a bit more clarity and confidence in your ability to do that, to understand the players in the system in which ag lending takes place, and to better understand the shifting scenarios we find ourselves in today. But there's a little bit more to learn. David and Brent bring us home after the break. This podcast is brought to you by AEI Premium. AEI Premium is a website, forecasting tool, and community for those looking for an edge in their decision-making process. Here's David with more on what AEI Premium members get, from understandable stories to actionable insights.
There is also chaos in decision-making when we have two things that don't offset each other, but they amplify each other, they feed off each other. And those two ingredients are uncertainty and a deluge or a torrent of information. And so we think about something around maybe interest rates, a big uncertainty here, or maybe commodity prices, energy prices, geopolitical issues. Those are big uncertainties. But then we think about all the information that's flooding our decision-making process. What happens is when we turn up the information spigot between social media and traditional media and people talking about it at the coffee shops, it's really hard to find the nuggets from the noise or the key pieces that are valuable. And so what we do at AEI and with AEI Premium is to help decision makers insulate themselves from the chaos. And we believe there's two ways to do that. One of them is better content that allows this data-driven insight. We think about these uncertainties before they become mainstream, or once they become mainstream, we turn down the noise a little bit by sharing lots of data, lots of history to help you navigate that. And the second piece is better mental models, better tools to help you navigate this. History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. So there's ways that we can pull ideas from historic experiences or experiences of other industries that help us size up what this uncertainty, what this risk might look like, and to help us move through that.
To get the full story with AEI Premium today, head online to aei.ag. AEI Premium, be your own guru. Now, back to the show. In the final part of my conversation with David and Brent, I wanted to start with their perspective on situations like Borson Farms and hear what they think there is to learn about ag debt from situations where leverage becomes the ultimate destructive force. It surprised me that the first thing we talked about was not credit, but luck.
I think there is a tendency to associate success with financial success. There's also true that luck plays a role in that whole process. It goes back to that old saying of the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules.
I thought it was do unto others until you want to be done unto you, but that's the other golden rule.
It's the other version of the golden rule. And I think there's evidence that those people at least are able to manage that. And we know there's some people who aren't very good at managing money at all. Does that make them inferior people? No, in no way. I don't think anybody would necessarily agree with that. So there is a skill or an ability or whatever to it. There are times, I think, when credit gets in the way of that. They may have been really good at operating the business and doing all that stuff, but if they had made what turns out in hindsight to be a poor credit decision, they borrowed too much money at the wrong time, expanded at the wrong time. It doesn't matter how good a businessman they were or person they were, they're going to have significant trouble. It's perceived that if this person has a lot of money, they're a genius or something. And in some cases, that may be true. In some cases, it may not be. They may have gotten really lucky. But luck plays a big role in lots of things. and lots of history. The weather could have been bad on D-Day. It wasn't. It cleared.
Digging a little deeper, David was quick to point out that when we hear a story like Borson Farms, we have expectations about how it will go, and that those expectations often color our ability to actually learn from them.
As humans, we always want simplified summaries of what happened. And think about the 1980s farm crisis or the 2008 recession. We all want like a very tight story. And if it's a 90-minute movie, that's okay. But we really like to have two or three tweets that really explain like why this happened. In fact, we love to find villains. We love to have these simplified stories of this person did bad and that's why it happened. But it reminds me of a story, I believe it came out of Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, and he said that a typical plane crash involves seven consecutive human errors. And the idea here is that it's not one thing that goes wrong that causes a catastrophe or even two things. It's these things just start to hit and they're independent and on their own, or even two or three of them lined together doesn't cause a problem, but they cascade and they all play off each other. It causes problems. And so how fast things can change and how we think, okay, we have this all understood. We know the risks that we're facing. We have this data. We feel confident that we've been able to make good loans. We've had good underwriting processes. And then all of a sudden stuff starts to play out in an unexpected way. And all of a sudden we find out that we missed this risk, or we missed this in underwriting, or we didn't price this appropriately. And it might not have been a problem, but all of a sudden we got to this extreme situation. And in fact, you could do 6.5 of these steps wrong, but all of a sudden the seventh mistake happens in the right sequence and it causes a catastrophe. I think that's the hard piece, is that we're really good at maybe looking at these individually. It's the collection of them that really make it hard for us as humans to think through. And it also makes it really hard to learn the lessons. It makes it really hard to have a really thoughtful understanding as to what went wrong and how do we learn from this going on in the future. And we've talked about this a lot. The debt to asset ratio is probably at the sector level that warning sign. And we all look back at that data and says, aha, no wonder they had a problem. This got too high. They should have known. But there was so much more going on in the background. And there are so many more variables that contributed, but that also we don't understand when we just look at that one chart.
When we think about the stuff going on in the background of past farm financial crises, it's easy to discount it through hindsight. But it's worth spending a lot of time thinking about what's going on in the background today. In the last 5 years, agriculture and the broader U.S. and global economy have been rocked by trade wars, a global pandemic, innumerable weather crises from droughts to flood to cold snaps and heat waves. Russia invaded Ukraine. Supply chain snarls have cramped economic activity. Inflation is on the rise around the world, and the Federal Reserve, as well as other central banks, are acting. Cryptocurrency rose to significant prominence and experienced an epic collapse. Farmland prices continue to climb, as do input prices across the board. Maybe in 10 years, it will be easy to look back and point out which of these and countless other events and trends really mattered and which don't. But from here, on the present edge, it's much, much harder to tell.
I think that's reality, right? Everything seems a little bit important, but then you look back, it's not. It feels important, but it's not. And then occasionally there is one thing that is like really important. We usually miss it, don't see it coming. And that's the really hard part about risk, is something is going to overturn the apple cart, but knowing exactly what it is really difficult. And that's why risk is such a hard thing to deal with and to manage.
It reminded me of that, to be completely cured of newspapers, spend a year reading the previous week's newspapers. I think that's this one way to think about what's really important, is if you read it a week or a month later, what still resonates and what still connects. I think one of the things I find valuable is to look at a long series of data. Sometimes it's really tempting to just look at the short term, this 3 or 4 year trend. And if we step back and understand more context, more history, it helps us put those pieces together. And I think the other thing that happens is there's this quote about the future is already here. It's just not uniformly distributed. And so there's this dopamine response that we get when we think we know something that other people don't know. And so finding that new information is really powerful, really addicting. And I think it's just this balancing act of what's relevant, what's actionable, how do I deploy it? Because it can be overwhelming We're kind of this new society where news finds you. You used to have to turn on the news or listen to the radio. No, it comes to you as alerts. It comes to you as notifications on your phone. And so it can be overwhelming to think through the big picture, the 30,000 foot implications whenever you're getting the latest breaking news of what so-and-so tweeted or what the Fed may or may not do at their next meeting. It's just completely overwhelming. So individuals have to figure out a way to insulate themselves from that chaos.
And that's the other thing is I think sometimes you think about, well, what would you do if you had that perfect information? What can you change? What would you do differently? And sometimes, honestly, you get it wrong, right? So try and figure out the strategies or whatever it is that will help you succeed no matter what, because we don't know exactly how any of this is going to unfold. But what we're saying, I think, is that there's a lot of possible different outcomes, and you want to have a business that's resilient and can thrive in that environment.
I think from Brent and David's perspective, and one that jives with most of our other sources, a resilient farm business strategy is one that, first and foremost, strives to understand the full scope of risks on the table.
People underestimate extreme risks consistently. You'll see people say, gosh, we had a 100-year flood. We've had two of them in the last 2 years. Really, they probably weren't 100-year floods to start with. We just really didn't understand how likely they were. We called them 100-year floods, but that was really a misnomer. They're not 100-year floods. Yeah, in the last 100 years, that's what happened. But really, if you wanted to say it was a 100-year flood, you should probably look back thousands of years or something. Why don't we do that? We don't have the data to do it. So we just consistently underestimate those extreme events.
Is it a 1 in 100 year event, or is it a 2 in 100 year event, or a 1 in 50? And if we don't have enough data, they both seem improbable.
After the risks are understood as well as possible, Brent points out, another meaningful strategy for increasing resiliency is diversification.
So diversification is usually viewed as a good thing, right? We're taught at an early age, don't put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, that's at its simplest form. So the idea, I think, of diversification holds merit. The problems with it come when we think we're diversified and we're not. So we get overly confident because we think we've diversified away all these risks, and we find out that, oh, by the way, that one event happened and it didn't diversify away the way we thought it would. It actually impacted all the borrowers in our pool. So that's one problem with diversification, is sometimes you think you're diversified and something comes along and it just blows it all out of the water and everybody ends up being stuck. The trade wars, a thing like that, it didn't really matter. Returns in most of the commodities were impacted by that. The other way people get in trouble with it is they don't do it properly, or they pursue it at all costs, and then they start making loans in areas they don't understand, geographies they don't understand, businesses they don't understand, and so they don't do a good job of underwriting the risk to start with. And so it gets so complicated that we just lose track of it all, and we make errors that we wouldn't make if we were stuck with lending to the businesses we really understand.
I think another piece of this is, what are the correlations between what we're diversifying? I think we've talked about this in different ways, but maybe 80% of the time, they're not correlated at all. And so when one does well, the other one does poorly, or vice versa. But there are just times whenever you roll the dice and it turns up unfavorable for all of the investments that you've made in this spot. You just want to make sure that you think about those maybe low probability, but risky potential outcomes that impact everything.
And finally, exercising caution and seeking to think in the long term rather than the short term is a key feature of resiliency.
My son the other day, he's 12 and he has his jobs around the place. And so he's earning some money because I try and incentivize him a little bit besides just yelling at him. And so now he's getting some money. So he's, Dad, I want this baseball box. okay, what is that? It's this box of stuff that comes every so often with baseball stuff in it. I'm like, how much is it? It's $40. I'm like, he's like, I got $40. I said, yeah, but do you realize that $40 happens every month? That's a lot. Yeah, but I can do this. And I'm like, so I'm trying to convince him to stay away from debt, because that's some ways it's a debt, it's a commitment. Like, be careful here what you're doing, because you're locking yourself into something and you're committing yourself for a long time of buying this stuff. And so you try and teach your kids to avoid these kind of commitments from the start. And I think that debt, we have this societal view that you just be careful with it, but it almost gets taken to the extreme sometimes, such that people want to avoid it at all costs. And that's not a good business decision either.
I think we talk a lot about the survivorship bias in decision making. It's this idea that if we only look at survivors and of maybe it's planes coming back from a battle or what the phones that we dropped that actually made it through, we say, okay, what was successful about these? And let's build more airplanes or more phones, corn hybrids that replicate that. But that can be misleading. And I think let's flip the survivorship bias upside down for a little bit and talk about what biases do we have about failures. And I think oftentimes, when we see a business fail or a farm fail, it's really quick to do a postmortem and see that there's a lot of debt or there's debt and debt was involved with that tragic end. And I think we oftentimes from that early age associate the demise of that business with too much debt. And oftentimes at the end of the road, there was too much debt relative to the earnings or relative to the assets or relative, but that debt in and of itself probably didn't cause the demise. It was other factors that were going into that. So, you know, I think that starts to impact our thinking a lot. Maybe our caution around debt is it's always linked to that tragic ending, that tragic finale. But as Brent mentioned, it's a tool and it's an important tool. Now, the more debt we use, the more leverage we use, the bigger the opportunities, but also the bigger the risks. And I guess I want to be careful there. You can definitely get yourself in trouble with just too much debt in and of itself, but not every business failure was because of the debt. I think another thing that debt represents is, going back to the baseball box, that debt represents a long-term obligation. And so we make these decisions today, and maybe the best of times or some really good times, or when that euphoria that Brent mentioned, it feels really good. And for buying a house or a farm or a tractor or a car, there are years associated with that. And the challenge is when those conditions change and so there's not as much income or there's not as much profitability, and we are stuck with those obligations through the downturn or through the cycles. And that gets really challenging. It's really hard to restructure or recalibrate our debt obligations beyond when we first take on those obligations and those liabilities.
I'll point out that during our conversation, Brent highlighted that it's not that the current ag sector necessarily lacks discipline. On the contrary, it's simply that credit has been very cheap for a very long time. Now that the cost of credit is rising, more and more people will appear to have been undisciplined, though part of the reality is that nearly 20 years of declining interest rates was a long time to build habits and strategies that fit that reality. New habits and new strategies and new levels of discipline are required moving forward. So where does this leave us? Ag lending is, without a doubt, a complex space that's intimately tied in, not only to the volatile world of global commodity ag, but also to many other unpredictable worlds, from government to investment firms to money markets and exchange currencies. For the last 20 years or so, agriculture's exposure to these other worlds through lending has been positive due to low and declining interest rates and lured more diverse investors into the space, keeping assets valuable, even while making it more and more difficult for beginning farmers to make a go. But the era of low and declining interest rates seems to be rapidly ending. The winds are shifting, and it's not totally clear how all the new players in and around agriculture are likely to act over the coming years. When we think about how a strategic farmer or agribusiness person is to navigate all this uncertainty, perhaps one of the important takeaways of all is the very first one that David elevated in our first season.
It reminds me of that
quote that maybe Mark Twain said. It's that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes.
Sometimes the rhymes turn out to be a little on the nose, like the way the Borson farm story echoes the Stamp farm story before it. But other times the patterns are more nuanced. Sure, Jay Powell, the current chair of the Federal Reserve, is not Paul Volcker, and it's unlikely that he will act in exactly the same way his predecessor did to bring down inflation. But the mission of the Federal Reserve to keep inflation at 2% has not changed. And Paul Volcker or not, the Federal Reserve only has so many levers it can pull to try and reach that goal. Will the next few years look exactly like the deflationary period of the late 70s and early 80s? Probably not. But as David suggests, it's likely to look something like it. Of course, agriculture has transformed significantly since that time, and is likely to benefit and suffer in different and hard-to-predict ways. The smartest decision-makers, though, know the difference between hard-to-predict risks and impossible-to-predict risks, and strive to understand all the possibilities that could threaten or disrupt their operations, and to understand the likelihood of those effects. We've talked about a number of hard-to-predict risks here, risks that exist within farm operations and within lending institutions. And in reality, all these risks matter to everyone operating in the system, because it's just as possible that the failure of an ag lender can negatively affect a farm or ag community as it is that a farm failure can negatively affect an ag lender. Granted, understanding and tracking these risks over time can be a bit like fighting the Hydra. Seemingly, as soon as you've understood one aspect, three new dimensions appear. And that's probably truer now than it's been for a few dozen years. But that's the challenge of farming and lending in a modern, ultra-fast and interconnected financial world. And it will only become more challenging as competition in agriculture becomes more globalized and more competitive. Navigating the farm financial system over the coming years will not only take the best information you can get your hands on and the best analysis you and smart people you trust can bring to it, it'll also take a good bit of luck and nerves of steel. Because despite all the risks, farming successfully over the next decade will almost certainly require using credit. After all, when it comes to today's highly capital-intensive farming, the wisdom remains: nothing borrowed, nothing gained. AEI.ag presents Nothing Borrowed, Nothing Gained as a production of AEI Premium, a website and forecasting community where ag nerds like us write, talk, and develop our ideas about the future of American agriculture. To learn more about becoming an AEI Premium subscriber and gaining access to a lot more great content like this podcast, visit aei.ag. If you've enjoyed this show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and look out for Ag Economic Insights on social media at Ag Economists, or email us directly at askus@aei.ag. This show was edited, produced, and co-hosted by me, Sarah Mock, along with David Widmar and Brent Gloy. A special thanks to all our recurring guests, including Mike Bolgi, John Blanchfield, Jim Knut, Brad Nordholm, Kurt Covington, Nate Franzine, Holly Bunn, Jeff Conrad, Thomas Honig, Jonathan Kappas, Jim Farrell, and Heather Malcolm. And further gratitude to the show's managers, Emily Rainieri and Sarah Hubbard, and the rest of the AEI team, including Jeff, Michael, Mason, and Aaron. And until next season, remember,
the good times never last.